Good morning and welcome to Black Book Talk, February edition 2019. I'm Emma Jackson Ford, bookwoman, here with
Patricia Hill Welch, librarian emeritus.
And we have a very special guest today, a guest who's not a stranger to us because it's Portland's own Renee Watson, who has written many books. She's written a new book, and she'll be coming to Portland again.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Good morning to you. And welcome.
Thank you.
Well, Renee, tell us about this new book. It's always good. We feel like we're scooping people. We hope we're the first local news outlet that's reporting on your book. So tell the waiting masses.
So this new book is called Watch Us Rise, and I co-wrote it with a good friend, Ellen Hagen, who is a poet, and we taught together for many years in New York, working with young girls in the Bronx mostly. And so this book is inspired in many ways by the young people that we've met and is about two best friends who start a women's rights club at their school in response to the unfair treatment that they feel they are getting because of what's happening in their after-school club. Chelsea is a poet, and in her club, they are reading dead white men. And she is like, really? There are so many other voices that we should be reading. So she's kind of raging against that and figuring out what she wants to say and who she wants to be and kind of standing against sexism in that way. And my character, Jasmine, is in a theater club that keeps typecasting her in roles that she feels are very stereotypical for Black girls. She's a big girl, she's dark-skinned, and she keeps getting to play the sassy, loud Black girl. She doesn't want to do that. So they quit their clubs and they start their own. And a lot of what they do in this club is write blog posts and poetry and do actions in the community to take a stand against sexism and racism. So the book is about two young budding activists who are finding their way and raising their voices.
These girls are living in New York, a different background from your other books, which have been about characters in Portland, and one of your books was in New Orleans. How did you come up with these New York girls?
Well, I wanted to write about some of the girls that I've met here, working in the Bronx, working in Harlem, the young girls that I've been mentoring and having writing workshops with. So it just made sense for us to write about girls who live in New York City. My character lives in Harlem, and Chelsea, she lives in Washington Heights. And we wanted to explore, like, what is it like to have to deal with racism in a city that is so diverse, right? So a lot of my writing has been about the Pacific Northwest and what life is for Black girls living there. And I think one of the things that we did with this book is show that even in very liberal spaces that are diverse, there still are issues, right? No place is without racism and sexism. And so these girls who are in a very diverse, very liberal environment still have to fight for what they believe in and raise up. And I think that's one of the things we wanted to kind of show and talk about in this book. So you can be progressive and still have room for growth.
And this book, like one other of your books, is a collaborative, right?
Yes. Yes. I wrote Betty Before X with Ilyasa Shabazz. And that's a middle grade novel. You know, it's historical fiction. So it's a very different process for what we did to write that book, which is very much based on Betty's life and wanting to pay tribute to her. It takes place in the 40s. You know, it's just such a different type of writing and type of book than this, which is young adult. And these girls are juniors in high school, so they're a little older. And yeah, there's, you know, city girls and contemporary girls. So it's been fun to write. You know, writing is such a solitary thing. You're by yourself a lot, and you're just having to get these stories out. So it's been really great to partner with people and collaborate and come up with plots and, you know, figure things out with someone. It's been great to not have to have to carry that burden all by myself.
That is wonderful. So, Renee, when will you be in Portland?
I will be coming back to Portland Friday, March 29th at 6:30 at the North Portland Library. And I'm bringing Ellen with me. I'm so excited that Ellen will be joining me for this event. We're going to read from the book, of course, and we'll perform some poems and take questions from the audience. And I'm really excited for her to meet my Portland family and friends. And, yeah, she's super excited to come. It's a free event. Young people are welcome. Friday, March 29th, 6:30, North Portland Library.
Okay, I have a question. You've said twice, I think, my character, your character, and the mechanics of people writing, you know, a single work together is always sort of mysterious to me. So you are the voice of Jasmine. She is the voice of Chelsea. But how do you work out all the in-between when they're not speaking, but you still have to keep the narrative going?
Right, and I left out an important part. So the novel is from both perspectives. So Jasmine has a chapter, then you hear from Chelsea, then you hear back from Jasmine, and we switch off each chapter. And we literally wrote together. We wrote the whole book side by side. Like, I would go to her apartment. We would plot out what was going to happen in the next, you know, 4 to 5 chapters, and we'd get to writing, and then we would share with each other. So, yes, we each wrote in the voice of a particular character, but we definitely shared and collaborated and gave each other feedback and would say, okay, well, if that's going to happen in your chapter, then I'll make sure this happens in mine, you know, and we were collaborating in that way and reading constantly each other's work so we could make sure that it gels together.
Okay. How long did it take for you to write this book?
Oh, my goodness. I think it probably took us about 1.5 years, and that's because, which is pretty long for me, but it's because in the middle of that, you know, Piecing Me Together came out and did very well and won all these awards. And so I was traveling so much last year that it just slowed down the writing process for me to be able to be with her and finish the book. So it's my fault that it took so long, and we're really just excited to finally be finished and to be able to share it with people, because we have been working on it for a while.
So while you're working on one piece, sometimes you start another?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Like right now, I'm writing, I don't know, about 3 different things right now. So yeah, I'm constantly in revision for something, you know, and then starting something brand new. That's kind of the life of a writer. So I always have many pots on the stove, boiling and simmering. And then some things I just have to put on hold when life just gets busy and it's too much to balance.
Well, in addition to writing and touring and doing workshops, of course, you are still, you know, working with the I2 Collective. And for those who might not know about this, in the summer of 2016, Renee launched I2 Arts Collective, a nonprofit committed to nurturing underrepresented voices in the creative arts. To my mind, and so the most important thing that you have done is to launch the movement to preserve the Langston Hughes Brownstone in Harlem. And I know you've done extensive fundraising and that you're in the house and have been there a few years, and that you do lots of workshops and other things for people of all ages. So tell us a little bit about the work that you're doing preserving this it's so important representation of Black cultural life.
Yeah, so like you said, we started 2 years ago, and it really was in response to just gentrification in Harlem. You know, having been raised in Portland and seeing how gentrification kind of has dismantled Northeast Portland and the Black community, I was just so sad that it's happening here too in Harlem, and wanted to make sure that we don't lose these sacred spaces. And I didn't want the Brownstone to just be a museum where people come and look, but I wanted to make sure that young people especially could come and add on to his legacy. So we're leasing the Brownstone where he lived for the last 20 years of his life, and we have poetry workshops and open mic nights and all kind of literary events and workshops even for adults as well, and are really building a community here locally, but also inviting folks who don't live in New York to come be a part by way of special retreats and intensives that happen in the summer. So, yeah, it's been a big project, and I'm very grateful for all the artists and writers who've come alongside me to help make it happen. We're ending Black History Month this month, celebrating his legacy by having a big fundraiser at the house on February 28th. And at that event, we'll have a silent art auction, and there'll be poetry readings and, you know, food and dancing and just a big celebration, but also that reminder of, you know, we really want to purchase because we don't want to lose this sacred space and see it, you know, become some kind of fancy coffee shop.
Yeah.
You know, so we are working to make sure that beyond me, that it could be a space for young people to carry forward his legacy.
Well, you have definitely established a national consciousness around the house. And last year on February 1st, you did a op-ed piece in the New York Times, Remembering Langston Hughes' Anger Alongside of His Joy. And I thought that was just such an eloquent expression of who this man was beyond the poet that most of us might be aware of. And I was hoping that you could read at least a portion of this. I urge any of you who can go online, go to the New York Times database, and see the full op-ed piece. But Renee, if you could just read some of this.
Sure. I'll start from the middle where I begin talking about when I learned about Langston beyond some of the more short poems that you learn, like Mother to Son and Dream Deferred. It wasn't until college that I learned that Hughes wasn't just a dreamer. The poet who wrote about deferred dreams was the same writer who wrote, "If the government can set aside some spot for an elk to be an elk without being bothered, or a fish to be a fish without getting hooked, or a buffalo to be a buffalo without being shot, there ought to be a place in this American country where a Negro can be a Negro without being Jim Crowed." Hughes wrote, "I swear to the Lord I can't see why democracy means everybody but me." The first day of February is the beginning of Black History Month. As we honor his legacy, I hope we remember this dreamer poet who loved Harlem and his people with a fierce, unapologetic love. As we commemorate his birthday, I hope we embrace his anger and frustration and remember not only his dreams, but also his demands.
Thank you. You are listening to Black Book Talk on KBOO FM in Portland, and we are talking to Renee Watson, internationally recognized and honored author, but still Portland's own. She is talking to us from New York.
And even though you just read a little bit from your op-ed piece, I'd really like it if you gave us just a little taste of your new book.
Oh, sure, yes. I will read from a blog post. So the girls, one of the ways that they are raising their voices is through art, which, you know, I believe that art is a way, especially for young people who are finding their voices, it's a way for them to be seen and to speak up and speak out. And so my character, Jasmine, writes this blog post trying to explain what it's like for her being a girl. It's called What It Be Like on Being a Girl. It'd be like men telling you to smile, sunshine, like your mouth being more familiar with saying yes and no. It'd be like hiding sometimes, wrapped in puffy coat, too loose dress, nothing clinging or low cut. It'd be like wanting to be seen and not wanting to be seen all at once. Like knowing you have the right answer, but letting him speak anyway. It'd be like second-guessing your know-how, like fact-checking your own truth. It'd be like older women telling you how to get a man, even if they don't have a man, even if you don't want a man. It'd be like trying to play hard to get, how to entice, how to be sweet honey always. It'd be like being told you are too sweet, too loose, too woman and not enough girl, too girl and not enough woman. It'd be like trying so hard to hold everything in emotion, brilliance, waste, breathe in always, never let out. It'd be like stomach cramps and bloated belly, like cravings and moods that change like spring days. It'd be like trusting the mirror when it shows you your beauty. It'd be like trusting your heart when it tells you who to love, who to walk away from. It'd be like knowing you can always start again, that you can always create and make something because you are made for birthing. It'd be like meeting other women, older and younger, living in no more breath. It'd be like their spirits are inside you, making you into something better and bolder every time you say their names, read their poems, learn their legacy. It'd be like knowing you are what praying women had in mind when they travailed for tomorrow. It'd be like knowing you are a promise, a seed. It'd be like knowing without you planted and watered and nurtured, the world can't go on.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Watch us rise.
Okay. As we mentioned earlier, you will be in Portland soon. And in fact, you managed to find a way to come back home at least once a year, no matter what else you're doing. So could you tell us a little bit more about what you'll be doing when you are in Portland?
I will be in Portland on Friday, March 29th, at the North Portland Library, which is such a dear space to me because it's the library that I first, you know, was checking books out of and learning how to read and growing as a reader and writer right down the street from Jefferson High School, my school. So it's always special to come back to that space and share work. And this time I'll have Ellen with me. We're going to read from the book and also perform some of our own solo pieces and then just be in conversation with the audience and take questions and, you know, sign books if people purchase books. I think Broadway Books is going to be the bookseller that evening. So, yeah, it'll be a community event, and I'm hoping that families come out, that young people are there. And then I'll be back again in the fall to do school visits and author visits and teach some poetry workshops to young people.
And as always, the library event is free, so, you know, you really have this opportunity to see nationally recognized artists, especially nationally recognized African-American authors. So, you know, we hope that the whole family will come out, everyone will come out and support this.
Are you going to be reading, doing book readings all over the U.S.?
Yes, you know, I just feel so blessed that my work has taken me to so many places. We will be touring extensively here in the U.S., and then I will also be going to New Zealand and Australia and Amsterdam this spring and summer. So I'm very excited to be on an international book tour for my work, for Watches Rise and also for Piecing Me Together and The Sight of Home.
Okay. You won, let me see, Coretta Scott King Award and a Newbery Award for Piecing Me Together?
Yes.
The opportunity to travel internationally, is that like a direct result of winning that award, or is this something that would probably have happened just because you have so many best-selling books? Tell us how that works, because I'd like to know how one gets to travel around the world. I'm sure many of our listeners would like to know this, too.
I think that what awards do is give you visibility, right?
Mm-hmm.
I know that there are some libraries, there are some spaces that solely curate their library space based off of those lists. And so the more you're on any best of list or you're on the poster of all the winners of the Coretta Scott King Award or something like a Newbery Honor, which, you know, for a children's lit, that's like an Oscar or a Grammy. So those opportunities come, I think, because now I'm just more people are seeing my name and the book cover. And so they invite me to come. I think it's been a perfect storm of, you know, the more books you have, hopefully the more recognition and the better you're getting as a writer. I think that's happened. I'm growing. The visibility, the Langston Hughes House, like all of that is kind of working together to give me a platform. And I'm hoping that I do write by that platform and make sure that if I'm given this privilege to travel and show up in spaces that I come with something to say and come with an open heart to hear what young people have to say and make sure that they feel seen and validated and that they're sharing their stories.
It's Speaking of the Langston Hughes House, isn't there a fundraiser going on right now?
Sure. Well, you know, nonprofits, there's always fundraising going on. So absolutely. People can always give online. Our website is i2arts.com, and it's two as in T-O-O from his poem, I Choosing America. So people can donate that way online. And then, yes, in New York City, on the 28th, we have our big fundraising event to celebrate his legacy, where we'll have a silent art auction and people can bid on art and give that way.
And the fundraiser right now is to purchase the brownstone?
Yes. So we're currently leasing the space and we would like to purchase it. So all fundraising that we're doing this year is to make sure that we can at least get a down payment for the brownstone so that we can purchase it and start, you know, making sure that this is not just a thing that is happening now, but that it can be set in stone forever, even after I'm gone and not the ED anymore, that it can always be a space that is set aside to carry on his legacy and nurture writers of color and writers in marginalized communities.
Well,
I'm excited because Jacqueline Woodson and Jason Reynolds will be the hosts for the evening. And so, you know, they are living legends, and it's always awesome to have them come by. So they'll be reading poems and speaking about what it means to be seen and why this space is important to them personally. So I'm excited to have them in the space too.
Excellent.
We're closing out, but I just want to say two things. One, thank you for doing the work. You know, you work tirelessly in so many other areas, but if you hadn't gathered around you a group of people who were serious and willing to put in the hard work of saving the legacy of Langston Hughes, we wouldn't have an opportunity to support you. So thank you for doing that. And one of the things I've noticed, we've interviewed you a number of times. We've been to events with you. We know you. And though you really do have international acclaim now, but you have remained the same humble person, the same sweet person that we knew from the beginning. You do your family proud. You do Portland proud. And we are just so proud of you.
Yes.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate you saying that. Thank you.
Well, we will see you at the end of March. And I know we'll see you many more times after that. But thank you for our interview today.
Yes, thanks for having me, and I will see you soon.
All right.
All right. Until next month, this is Patricia Welch, Librarian Emeritus, saying good reading to you.
And Emma Jackson Ford, Bookwoman, saying see you in March. Okay.